Well, this is so exciting. We are welcoming in a brand new year of Torah reading. We have met. Did we meet? I think we met, sure. We met in the new year between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But there's always a few weeks where we're still finishing off the old cycle. Now we actually begin the new cycle. It is Parshas Bereishis, 5769. And those who have been attending the classes know that we got a little jump start in terms of our new approach for the coming year. We had been learning from regularly, religiously, from the Mesilas Yesharim all of last year. And this year, we have committed ourselves, Bli Neder, to start again, but this time really more in order of the Sefer, so that we are actually following along on the steps of the path. And there are 10 steps, 10 attributes, and our goal is, Bli Neder, partially outside of class, is to focus on a midah, on a virtue, for 40 days. And during those weeks, those Shabbos parshas that coincide with the particular virtue, we will try to soak up as much as we can from the parsha regarding that virtue. The entire time we learned the parsha in the new system, we were focused on the midah, the virtue of Torah study. We had actually 5 classes revolving around Torah study, starting with Re'e. So Re'e, Shoftim, Ki Seitze, Ki Sovo, or maybe, I don't know, we ended up with Nitzavim and Vayelech. All of that was focusing on Torah. We have now moved in, following the cycle of 40 days per virtue, we have now moved in to the virtue of Zehirus, of vigilance, or according to the old translation, watchfulness. We're actually on day number 15. So we've lost a couple of weeks because of our holiday season, but we are back on the track, and we are going to learn some insights from Parshas Bereishis on Zehirus, vigilance, watchfulness. So first in order is a brief redefinition, overview of what Zehirus is, what vigilance is. I refer you to the Mesilas Yesharim, the beginning of chapter 2, page 14 in the Feldheim edition, the translated edition. Chapter 2, the virtue of vigilance. I've got the... Okay. I'm just going to read the first paragraph of chapter 2, where vigilance is defined. The concept of vigilance relates to a person's actions and affairs. He must contemplate and survey his actions and his conduct to see whether they are good or not, so as not to risk the loss of his soul, heaven forbid. He must not pursue his habits thoughtlessly, the way a blind person walks as in darkness. Okay, vigilance. Be aware. Be conscious of what you are doing. Because the alternative to vigilance is walking around, walking through life thoughtlessly. We will be taken over by our habits. We are taken over by our instincts. We will do that which we have been accustomed to doing day in and day out, year in and year out, unless we use our minds. And we all have a mind. In the next paragraph, he says, if a person was given such a powerful gift as a mind to think, what a waste not to use it. And human beings are totally comfortable and capable of living through life awake but not really thinking. We are totally capable of doing that. And what happens is we end up doing come what may. Now, what we'd like to do in this class, in Parshas Bereishis, from a very religious point of view, and I would add mystical point of view, from the writings of Rabbi Luzzatto in a smaller, more obscure composition. I only know about it because it's printed in the back of this edition of the Mesilas Yesharim, the Hebrew edition of Path of the Just. And I had only looked at it first this year on Rosh Hashanah. So I found some fascinating insights from Parshas Bereishis, which is really going to drive home the point of Zahiris. In other words, the question that we're going to explore today is, why does it matter so much whether we are vigilant or not? What's wrong with walking through life, what the author calls thoughtlessly? So what? I still have a good life. Why is it imperative that we be vigilant and thoughtful about what we do? So that is our goal for today. I just wanted to add a little bit more to the definition of vigilance by quoting from the beginning of chapter 3, which is the elements of vigilance. Rabbi Luzzatto always defines first a concept, and then he fleshes out more practically what this looks like. So he says, what does vigilance look like? He says, two methods are necessary for one who wishes to oversee his conduct, i.e., live with thought. On the one hand, he must ponder what constitutes the true good that a person should choose and the true evil that he should flee from. Part one is, let's get a working definition of good and evil. On the other hand, he must see if his own deeds are good or evil. Part two is assessment of one's own deeds and paths vis-a-vis that definition that he set. This applies both to deeds at the time of their performance and to deeds performed in the past. And the way one does that assessment is twofold. One learns how to think while he's doing, be aware of his decisions as he is making them. And number two, one takes time to reflect and review his past deeds. One gets into the routine of doing that ideally every day, and being able to do that instant replay in one's mind and say, ah, I see what I did. I remember now the way I was talking to so-and-so. I wasn't very nice, was I? That's a part of vigilance. That's the review mode. There's the active mode. I don't just do things. I don't shoot off my mouth. First I think about what I'm going to say before I say it. That's the active mode. And then there's the review mode. I think back over my day and I ask, how did I do today based on my definition of good and evil? All right. Just again, we will be discussing vigilance for the next several weeks with God's help. And so just again to refresh the definition of what it is. And now we dive in to Bereishis, the deepest of all the parshas of the week. It really is the deepest. We really have the least amount of understanding of the depth of this parsha, and everyone says that. Okay, so I present with you some thoughts that I have organized from a small selection of this Sefer that I learned for the first time, called Derech Eitz Chaim, which, by the way, the title Derech Eitz Chaim comes from the Parsha too. Hashem placed Adam into the Garden of Eden, and then he had to banish him. And there were two trees in the garden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and then there's the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. And he was told not to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and he ate from it, so he was banished. Why was he banished? Lest he eat from the tree of life. And in his current state, God didn't want him to live forever anymore. So he took him out of the garden, and he put this sword guarding the entranceway to guard against going in and eating from the tree of life. Derech Eitz Chaim, to take away his access to the tree of life. That's the name of this little composition. Derech Eitz Chaim. Okay. It starts as follows. And you can participate in this little presentation here. We have two systems in the physical world that we are familiar with. Two brilliant, miraculous systems. One is the system of birth of a human being, and the other is a system of growth of the plant kingdom. How does the process of birth work? There's a man and there's a woman. The man contributes a seed. The woman takes that seed and magically turns it into a baby. Right? It is the man's influence. It is the man's contribution. And then it is formed by the woman and in the woman's body to create a miraculous being called Adam, a person. Now, the first man wasn't created that way. He was created from the earth. We'll come back to that a little later. The other system, no less miraculous, is the system of plant growth. A man, a farmer, takes a seed, which was created by God in the fruit. He puts it into the ground, his contribution. He waters it, he tills the soil, etc. Puts some fertilizer in, maybe. And then the ground takes that seed and magically makes something out of it. Makes a plant grow. First, a little shoot, and then roots, and then the shoot turns into a trunk or whatever the plant may be. And soon, new fruit is produced. Both of these systems are miraculous. And if you don't believe in God after observing any of these systems, you really need to see a shrink. Mm-hmm. What do we know from our Parsha, from reading our Parsha, about these two systems? Please. What insights do we have about these two systems from our Parsha? Would anybody like to offer something?
What insights? Just be a little bit more.
Did you learn? Okay. Did you learn anything from Parshas Bereishis that you didn't know from ninth grade biology?
Yes, I think so. Ninth grade biology. Hashem was not involved. We didn't. I don't recall studying that God created the heavens and the earth. So that really is the initial introduction into life. It's the original life as we understand it.
And I didn't really describe that part. I just described the systems themselves. I really described them almost like a ninth grade biology book would. I said that a thinking person would come to the conclusion that there must have been a God, but that was an afterthought. The system itself of both birth and of plant life is pretty much as we observe it. But there's something that we learn in the Parsha that radically alters our understanding of these systems.
Well, when you were describing them, and also in the Parsha, it makes the point that man is involved.
Mm-hmm. Which he is. And I wasn't referring to the original creation where both man was formed by God from the earth, or that God formed the trees and the grass and whatnot, but only from then on. And that's the way it's described, and that's the way we learned about it in biology.
Well, we learned good and evil with the story of Cain and Abel.
No, that's it, but that's getting off into a different realm. That's just about these two systems.
I think the only thing that we know in the Torah that we don't know from a biology book is that these systems are infinite. In other words, they don't really have a beginning and an end, per se, because God talks about the world coming into being as an ongoing process, not that he created the world, but that the world is creating, is being created or recreated every minute that we're alive. And I think normally when you think about systems like this, you think about a beginning and an end. If you're looking... I'm kind of reaching here a little
bit,
but
you're getting. It is inside, and it's actually. I'm not even going that complicated.
Okay.
I'm actually going on the simple story level,
okay.
Or the very process level. Yeah. Shua, do you have anything to say?
All I was going to say was really mentioned already that at the first time it was not the study process. It was Hashem created the Adam the way he is and created the. Plants the way he is, and then the process happens from there. The initial act wasn't from the in that process.
Okay, now, that's true. But again, that's we're starting after that.
Yeah.
But I think we need just to refresh our memory a little bit. So there's the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and then there's the story of the serpent. And enticing them to eat from the forbidden fruit, and then they're cursed. What are these curses?
Exile.
But specifically regarding these systems.
Man has to eat from the ground, he has to toil into something.
Mm-hmm. Serpent will crawl into dust, and woman will... bear children.
Woman will bear children. She would have borne children up beforehand, but she will bear children in pain. She will suffer, and she will have pain in childbirth. How were children born before that? Interestingly enough, were Cain and Abel born before or after Adam and Eve were banished from the garden?
After.
Why do you guess after?
Just sequentially.
Because
it came after.
Because everything happened in one day. How could they have been born beforehand if Adam and Eve were created and that day they were banished? So clearly the boys must have come after the move.
Well, before they were banished, though, birth took place just like that.
Ah, so the answer is it happened before. It happened before. But it happened without pain and suffering and pregnancy.
How do we know this?
How do we know this? Because Rashi tells us, now you have to believe Rashi, but Rashi says, where is Rashi so I don't mix up?
Rashi is quite a fellow.
3:16. He's getting it from the oral tradition. He does not making it up from scratch. 3:16. Mm-hmm. You sure you found it?
I have a footnote in verses 4 now.
What does he say?
Well,
as she's being cursed?
If you look on page 17, footnote 16.
Okay. Before the sin, Adam and Eve lived together, and she conceived and gave birth immediately and painlessly. Now that would change. Conception would not be automatic, and there would be an extended period of pregnancy and labor pains. Okay, so the Sephorno says it explicitly. Rashi also says the same thing, but... okay, I can't find it at the moment. I thought I wrote it in my notes. But Rashi says that they were immediately conceived and born right then and there, and then they were banished. Okay, so the system... Okay, got to believe this part. The system took place, but it took place without pain, without effort, and quickly. What about the other system, the system of plant growth? So again, in the curse, Adam is told, in chapter 3, verse 17, to Adam he said, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Accursed is the ground because of you. Through suffering shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall it sprout for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. By the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread until you return to the ground from which you were taken. So likewise, this is understood by all the commentators to mean that man would be able to produce fruit without any waiting time and without any pain and effort, without toil. So what we learn from this parsha is that originally, this is what they don't tell you in ninth grade biology, is that originally these two systems were very different than they are today. They were still systems, but they happened, as Rabbi Lutzato says in the Derech Eitzchaim, b'menucha, in a restful state, without toil. He says this is part of the meaning of when God put them in the garden to begin with. It says, v'yanichehu b'gan Eden, La'avda u'lashamra. He placed them, and he uses the word place, not lasim, okay, this is a Hebrew thing. He didn't use the verb lasim, which is to place, but he used the word lehaniach, which also shares the root of menucha, of rest. So God created the world that there should be these systems in a state of rest. Now, but again, in both systems, so you might ask the question, well, why did he make the systems all together? Why didn't he just, like poof, you know, here's the baby. Or, poof, here's the fruit. Why did he even have to go through the, employ the systems at all? So the answer is, and we'll see this a little bit more clearly, because this is really where it comes in to our lesson, Hashem wanted there to be involvement of the man. Now, there's a third system. And we will learn that this third system parallels the other two. Is there a third system in the ecosystem that we have not mentioned yet? This third system is in the spiritual.
I was going to say the soul.
Well, yes. What is the system that God envisioned for man? Well, he placed God, it says that he created Adam. What was the original plan?
To live forever.
What should he do all day? If she didn't have to bear children with pain, and so she didn't have to take any, you know, childbirth classes, he didn't have to go to work, what would they do all day long?
He studied with the sequel of Rabbi Goldberg.
he would go to Parsha class, but it wasn't a lunch. Yeah, it was still lunch and learn. He ate lunch. But the... what they would do... Okay, where is the verse
they
that says...
Mm-hmm. And then they could
pull down
and launch
while they learn. Vayikach, this is 2:15. Vayikach Hashem Elokim es Adam. Hashem took man. Vayanichehu v'gan Eden. He placed him in Gan Eden. Again, using this word, vayanichehu, restful processes. La'avda ul'shamra. Translated, to work it and to guard it. So everybody makes an association with the way things are today. And Adam had his hoe and his pickaxe, and he would be tilling the soil. And he would guard it. He would stand by and make sure that the ravens didn't come or the crows didn't come and eat the fruit of the garden, right? No. If you look at the footnote to 15 to 18, Man in the Garden, page 13, Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden to work it and to guard it. The Midrash interprets this allegorically. Since the Torah mentioned above that the trees of the garden grew of their own accord, and the river provided the necessary irrigation, rather, Adam was to work the garden through the study of Torah and the performance of positive commandments, and to guard it by refraining from forbidden activities. This means that man's task in this world is to serve God. If he does that, then his material needs will be satisfied, as Adam's were in Eden. For to think that only physical exertion can bring success is to believe in an illusion. So this is how the Derech Eitz Chaim explains the original intent of man in this world. Truly, man was to do some kind of work. We know that man is called Adam, and Adam shares a common root with Adama, the ground. Just as the ground catches the seed and takes that seed and works its magic, like we described before, with or without pain or suffering or toil, but it does something. It takes that initial seed from God and converts it into something beautiful. Just like the woman takes that seed and nurtures it and miraculously turns it into something beautiful, Adam was to take the influence from above, the spirit, the soul, the Torah that God gave him, he would process it through his being and turn it into something beautiful, or better yet, turn himself into something beautiful. That's why he is Adam. That's why he's ground-like, because he takes the seed and he turns it into a beautiful plant. He himself needs to be developed. He's got this rich potential. He's got this soul. He takes the influence from above and he turns it into a beautiful plant himself. That's what man's job was to be. It would be a completely spiritual existence, meaning he was a body, but God would help take care of his bodily needs with menucha, with rest, while he would be involved in tilling the spiritual soil. That is the way it was supposed to be. And indeed, in Derech Hashem, a sefer that we quoted many times in the past, he explains this quite clearly. Yes, there was still a force of good and a force of evil, and he would have to make some choices, but it was easy to make those choices. When Adam was first created, he was precisely in the state composed of two equal opposites, body and the soul. His environment contained both good and evil, but he was balanced. The appropriate thing for him to have done would have been to choose the good. Had he done so, his soul would have overcome his body, and the spiritual would have dominated the physical. He would have then immediately attained perfection, and it would have remained with him forever. The soul has a function to take man's physical body and elevate it until it can take pleasure from perfection along with the soul. If Adam had not sinned, he would have been able to attain this total perfection. His soul will have purified his body step by step until he reached the level required to permanently partake of the everlasting bliss. In other words, Adam had a job to do. That job would have been accomplished had he used his soul and turned himself into a beautiful spiritual tree. Soul and body together.
His failure was a lack of vigilance.
Now, not yet. Not yet. That comes after the failure.
Okay.
The failure was that the influence that God had provided for the evil, i.e. the serpent, made his influence upon Adam and Eve, and they followed his advice. When that happened, there went all of the rest, the menucha, no more menucha. There went all of the ability to accomplish the task easily. Suddenly, it became a long, arduous task to make these systems work. Both the system of birth now has to be accompanied by pain and suffering, the system of plant growth, and even the system, or maybe most importantly, the system of man developing himself as a servant of God. Now, the way that that happened is explained in the Derech Eitz Chaim, and I'm going to describe it. I'm going to paraphrase from him in just a moment, just to show you that this theme is, you know, consistent throughout. Back to the Derech Hashem, just continuing where we left off. When Adam sinned, however, things were greatly changed. The amount of evil that existed initially was just enough to assure that man would be in a perfect balance, allowing him to gain perfection through his own efforts. When man sinned, though, he caused evil to increase, both in himself and in all creation. As a result, it became more difficult for him to attain the perfection that God intended for him. So, before the snake, before the sin, there were these systems in place, but they were easy, they were restful, afterwards, more difficult. Now, to kind of bring it to a close, to a head, we will now read from the Derech Eitz Chaim, and then after that, we will just cap it off with an understanding of why vigilance is so important. From all of this, we can understand that this was the purpose for which man was created. It should have been that the only reason he was here was to do this work of perfecting himself through the service of God in the garden. And that's why it says he placed him with using the word menucha in the Garden of Eden to work it and to guard it. Our sages explained those are the positive mitzvos that he had and the negative mitzvos that he had. All of it would have been done with physical ease. But after the sin, now man is caught between two different paths. He now has two different masters. This is explained in the Talmud with the following pithy expression. Oili mi yotzri, oili mi yitzri. Woe is to me from my master. Woe is to me from my inclination. In other words, man now has two masters. On one hand, he's got the master of the world, God, who says, man, Adam, I got this job for you. I've got this spiritual work. You're supposed to perfect yourself, make yourself a beautiful tree. And then he's got his other master, the serpent, who's saying, I got some delicious fruit for you, Adam. Delicious. It'll make you wise. It's very physically pleasing. Now he's got that master to listen to also. Says, continues Rabbi Luzzatto, whatever a person is doing in life which comes under the category of Avodas Hashem, service of God, okay, as defined by our Torah, when he's doing that, he is actually fulfilling his original purpose for which he was created. What about when he's doing other things that are not in the Torah, particularly that the Torah doesn't permit? Then he's serving the Nachash. And the Nachash, his whole goal, his whole job, is to try to divert us. He wants to get us involved in other things, in alternatives. His job is to make us go away from God, distracting us from our service. Why have we been stuck with this? What did we do to deserve this Nachash, this other master that's trying to distract us? It was our punishment, because that's the path that man chose. We were told in the Shema that if you turn away from God, va'avadetem Elohim acherim, you will indeed serve foreign gods. That's a punishment. That's our consequence, shall we say. When God gave us a choice, he said, live up to your intended purpose. If not, if you take another choice, you're going to have to follow that. It's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because the sages teach, in the way that a person wishes to go, that's the way he is led. In other words, when you make a decision, you have to live with the consequences. You stick with God, then you will continue to follow God. You turn away, you find another path, an alternative, you listen to the other guy, and then you will find yourself following him more and more. And that is the way man resulted after this decision. That's basically what he says. We've got these two masters. It's the consequence of that first choice that man made, Adam made. Let's not get into the question about why do we have to suffer for his decision. Obviously, there is something purposeful to our current state as well, because, in fact, the Torah was given. Except for chapter 1, 2, and 3, the Torah is addressing us after the sin. So right now, our job is to live and survive and thrive in the new state. That's our job. But now we understand what Zahirus is all about. Because if a person lives life, like Rabbi Luzzatto says, thoughtlessly, guess what? When you don't think, which master do you think gets all of the publicity? Which master gets the popularity? The other one. Because it's not easy to follow God anymore. It's challenging. It's just as challenging as having a baby or planting a field. So if we take the mindless route, we're just going to spend all of our time doing exactly what he wants us to do. Get diverted. Do other things. Have fun. It takes thought. It takes zehirus. It takes vigilance and watchfulness. And be careful in order to keep focused on the other master. Those are our two choices. They're both there. They're both strong. In fact, the other side is stronger. The only hope we have is to work. Our primary work is given our power of choice. And of course, how do we do the, how do we make the right choices? For that, we know the answer. What brings us to vigilance? What did Rabbi? What in the ladder brings us to vigilance?
Torah.
There's the answer. Here we are starting to read Bereishis again. We just celebrated the completion of the Torah and the beginning. We celebrated the starting of the Torah. In other words, as long as we have our Torah to look at, to guide us, and as long as we commit ourselves to use our minds to follow that Torah, we're on the right path. But that is the crucial step of Zahirus. The fact that we have received the Torah is worth very little if we don't study it and if we don't apply our minds to it. And it's not just to the study of the theoretical, what's written here, but it's applying it, like Rabbi Luzzatto says, applying it to myself. You know, what are the goals that I should set for myself at my given my particular state, my particular stage? What should I be doing? What are the positives? What are the negatives? And then, how am I doing?
It sounds like you're saying that this is an intellectual process, and I guess I would argue that this is more an act of the heart than an act of the brain.
You said the same thing in a previous class, I remember. I was listening to it on the CD.
But I mean, I go back to the Shema.
Yeah, you know, said that there too.
I know, but I that's what got
right, you're
me.
Right.
That's what motivates
you're right.
me.
You're right.
If otherwise, if I rely
you're right.
on rationalizing
no,
things,
no, no.
I can make bad choices.
I'm not talking about being a philosopher. I'm talking about studying Torah. I'm talking about, as Rabbi Luzzatto is going to teach us, vigilance requires a daily accounting. You know what it really requires? You study Torah regularly, and you also keep a log. That's what it requires. You keep a log. If you want to remember something, keep a log. Make just like we do for our grocery list. Make a list of the things you need, and then when you're in the store there, check it off. Did I get the cucumbers? Did I get the milk? Did I get the eggs? You got to do the same thing for Zahirus. Make a list. These are the things I need to be trying to do. These are the things I need to be trying not to do. Check them off every day. How did I do? That's what you need.
To be self-aware. All I'm saying is that it's a necessary condition to be self-aware, but it's not sufficient. You have to go beyond the intellectual to the heart.
Well, this is more than even the heart. This is practical. This is hands-on. Zahirus is hands-on.
But it doesn't necessarily mean anything if your heart is not enlisted in the process. If it's purely kind of walking through, going through the motions and checking off boxes and doing all the rituals and thinking that miraculously you're going to be close to God as a result of all that, I'm not sure I agree with that.
You have to use all of your abilities.
Yeah.
Just like the farmer uses all of his know-how and all of his muscles. So a man has to use his heart, his mind, everything. But he's got to do it.
Yeah.
What's most important is he's not just thinking and he's not just theorizing. He's actually doing it. He's being a Zahir. And of course, that does not negate all of all the ingredients leading up to that. But vigilance requires being on task. Why? Why do I have to be so vigilant? Why can't I just kind of live my life laissez-faire? Because we don't have that luxury anymore, because otherwise we might be answering to the call of our other master.
It's a slippery slope, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a discipline and a framework. If you adhere to these virtues, you stay out of trouble that way.
That's right. I've always thought that the Mesilas Yesharim is not so much teaching us new commandments. He's giving us the skills, the life skills, to be able to follow those commandments.
Yeah,
and in Zahirus, you see it very, very clearly. As we continue to move on, we'll really see how to implement Zahirus, and it's so urgent because because we're living in a, as our Parsha teaches us, we are living our life with two masters, and one of them gets the upper hand, particularly if we are being mindless about what we do. So, welcome back to all of us to the new cycle of the Torah. It's extremely invigorating to start again at Bereishis, and we look forward this year once again really to engage in this process of following the Mesilas Yesharim in an extremely practical, moving, and effective, and fully engaging way, as the Torah was meant to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.